episode of Mormon Expression. I'm going to be your co-host tonight, Glenn Ostlund, and at my side is Heather.
Hello.
Heather, you're our co-host. So do you want to introduce the rest of the panel?
Sure. We have got with us Tom.
Hey, what's up, Glenn and Heather co-host?
Hey.
And also Randy.
Good evening, everyone.
And Andrea.
Hi, everybody. Brian, don't say hi to me.
Hey, what's up, man?
All right. And so what are we doing tonight, Heather?
We are talking about the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis.
What are the Screwtape Letters, Heather?
Yes, the Screwtape Letters. Published in 1942, it was one of Lewis's most popular books. He said it wasn't a difficult book to write, but that he hated the process, and that he also wished that he could write from an angelic perspective to provide some balance in the book, but he didn't know that it was possible for men to do so.
Who is C.S. Lewis? Who is this guy?
He's the guy that wrote Narnia, Glenn.
Yes.
Narnia? Was he a Mormon, Tom? I don't understand. Who is C.S. Lewis?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Are you on a count for how many Tom size we can get in this?
No. I'm just trying to set the stage for you. You know, you wanted to talk about how he's like a, hidden Mormon or something?
Well, I mean, C.S. Lewis is kind of a pseudo-celebrity among Mormons, right? I assume that's why we're talking about this, right? Because it's
he's like the non-Mormon Mormon that gets quoted in conference, right?
Yeah.
One of the favorite ones to bring up all the time. You know, C.S. Lewis, if C.S. Lewis said it, it might as well be someone important like Nibley.
Yes, that's how I grew up understanding it anyway.
Yeah. So you said, Heather, that C.S. Lewis mentioned that writing Screwtape Letters was a difficult process. What was it that was difficult for him?
Well, he seems like a very spiritual guy, somebody that's all that at every moment of his life he's wrapped up in his spirituality. And to write the Screwtape Letters, he had to put himself in the mind frame of a devil or a demon taunting humans. And it was kind of a miserable experience. It kind of felt mentally like he was suffering, I guess. That his life was devoid of any pleasure or joy or happiness while he was working on it.
Can I cut in? I had my mute button on. I was trying to interject a little earlier about C.S. Lewis and his tie to Mormonism.
Yeah.
I did a thorough 15 seconds of research on the internet, and I wanted to find out if C.S. Lewis ever mentioned Mormons, because we know that the love affair goes from Mormons to him for sure.
Uh-huh.
And he never mentioned once Mormons. The closest he came to mentioning Mormons was a woman who kept writing him over and over from Salt Lake City. All he said when she asked about all the different denominations was, he says, "I just teach mere Christianity, but I do tend to not like the religions that preach abstinence to alcohol as a requirement."
That's
the closest he ever came, and that is very obtuse. There was a guy named Richardson and Thackeray, two devout Mormons, did some research to find out how many times C.S. Lewis has been quoted. And he has been referenced 100 times in church-sponsored publications. One-third of those are during General Conference talks. So over 30 General Conference talks have a C.S. Lewis quote in them.
When was that research done?
Oh, geez, you're going to call me on my 15 seconds?
It was only 15 seconds. Okay, we'll leave it at that.
It was 2009, June of 2009.
Okay, hey, good job.
And just some other tidbits. Can you guys guess who number one, as far as quoting him, which general authority?
Neil A. Maxwell.
Yep, you guys nailed it. Nobody's even close. The next one then is Jeffrey R. Holland, then James E. Faust, and Dallin H. Oaks. And I remember in the 90s, that was when I served my mission. I watched conference a lot more back then. It seemed like there were some conferences where C.S. Lewis was quoted more than Christ. And that seems to have dropped off lately. And it makes sense since Elder Maxwell and Faust have died.
Whoa, that's heresy 101. You more than Christ? Come on. That's got to be.
Well, Jesus Christ wasn't as he wasn't as well published.
Oh.
I'm sorry, you didn't catch the tongue in cheek, and there was a joke somewhere in there, Tom. I'm sorry, but yeah, I mean, C.S. Lewis, over 30 general conference talks. He's definitely a favorite, and it was a favorite of a lot of general authorities.
Yeah. Well. Okay, so we've been talking about Screwtape Letters. We'll get back to Neil A. Maxwell in a moment, but just in case there are people listening that don't know what Screwtape is about, Andrea, can you give us a brief summary of what it is?
It is about it's a series of letters written from a demon, a senior demon who is now beyond tempting and has an administrative position. And he is writing letters to his nephew, Wormwood, who is new to the whole tempting business, and giving him pointers on how to lead his patient, as they call him, down to hell.
Yeah, so Wormwood's just gotten out of, like, the devil MTC.
Right, so he's on his first patient.
Right.
So Screwtape isn't the actual devil. It's not like Beelzebub, right?
No.
What? No.
No, the devil, like Lucifer himself, they call him
our father below.
Our father below, yeah. So he references it. But there's this whole lowerarchy, this organization of hell, and Screwtape is just one of many tempters or senior tempters. And so these are letters, and he's explaining to Wormwood how to tempt people, right? And so you mentioned earlier, Heather, that C.S. Lewis lamented that it was a difficult process for him because he had to get into the character of a devil, and that weighed him down. And he also said that he wished that he could write the antithesis of that, that he could have written the guardian angel side of supporting and guiding the patient, we kind of have some suspicions as to maybe somebody who picked that up. You want to talk about that, Randy?
You want me to talk about the Enoch letters?
I guess, yeah.
You picked me?
Well, you mentioned
Heather's the one that found it.
She'll flush it out.
Well, in the book,
the spirit's guiding me. The spirit's guiding
you. Okay, I feel it too. It's a burning somewhere in me.
Yeah.
I remember in the book, C.S. Lewis lamented the fact that he never got a chance to write kind of the antithesis to this book, which would be guardian angels' letters to try to, you know, prod and guide their patient, the same patient, towards God. And Heather was able to find the Enoch letters written by Neil A. Maxwell, and we kind of suspect that it's possible that Neil A. Maxwell kind of took, since he was such a fan of C.S. Lewis, took that to heart and wrote the Enoch letters. But Heather, why don't you tell us what the Enoch letters really are about?
According to Deseret Book, the description on their website, it's supposed to be about the city of Enoch that was translated in the Bible up to heaven without anybody having to die. And it's supposed to be letters to humans about what we could learn from the way the people in the city of Enoch lived and how we should, you know, emulate them to be better people. That's basically it. I haven't read it. I just know what I've seen in the description.
Did you read any of the excerpts?
No.
I read maybe two or three, and it was just such elevated, flowery language. I think if I actually got the book and read through it, I'd be pulling my hair out from it.
Sounds like something that you would want to read then.
Maybe. I might.
C.S. Lewis did say that to be able to write from the heavenly perspective, every sentence would have to smell of heaven. So perhaps that is what Maxwell
sounds
was
exhausting.
Going for.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're an apostle of the Lord and you're a special witness of Christ, you could kind of pick up that mantle and run with it. I can just imagine him reading C.S. Lewis and going, oh, yeah, I'm going to take a stab at that. And it's awesome. It's the city of Enoch. Great idea.
Well, I think we should give him credit, though, for not outright trying to plagiarize C.S. Lewis's idea. And he came up with a kind of sort of related one that he could use as an homage to C.S. Lewis's work.
Yeah, there were some pretty just in the brief excerpts that I read, pretty strong parallel homages.
Well, just the title, the Enoch Letters.
I mean, yeah, right. Yeah,
a little on the nose.
Yeah. All right, so Heather, do you want to lead us through a little bit more of the overview that you outlined?
Sure, definitely. I think it's interesting to point out that the tempters or the demons that are in charge of tempting people away from God are not allowed to fail. If they lose even one soul to God, if one person in their chain of people that they're trying to tempt dies a Christian, then they suffer the fate of what that human would have suffered. And they go to hell and are used as basically food for the other demons and tempters. And there's also kind of a side story going on in the book while he's writing all of these letters that expound upon the frailties of humanity and how Wormwood, his nephew, could use those frailties. There's also kind of a side story going on that Screwtape is not towing the party line. He is perhaps believing some of what God says and committing heresy by not expressing exactly what their father below would have them think. And that isn't fully fleshed out, but it is an interesting morsel that's thrown in along the way.
Well, I felt like it was fleshed out pretty well, though, that it was about love.
How so?
That
he loved his nephew?
Yeah. No. Well, because he was saying that God loves humans, that God actually loves the humans that he's created. And then he comes back and he says to Wormwood, oh, I hope you didn't report me for saying that, because of course that's heresy. God couldn't really love them. No, it's impossible. Love's impossible. That's right. An impossible concept. Of course not. No, not love. No, it's got to be something else, something that we just can't understand as devils. We just don't get it.
Right, that's how he's not towing the party line. He's not he's not saying that there is some ulterior motive on God's part.
Yeah.
He is, you know, using his own experiences and his own thoughts on God to instruct Wormwood, and that's not acceptable.
Yeah, so the heresy was when he said that God actually loves
them.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah.
Basically there are, I think, there's 31 letters between Screwtape and Wormwood, and each of them focus on a slightly different aspect of humanity and the chinks in our armor, things that could be used against us to drag us to hell, essentially.
Yeah.
Well, can I...
Yeah, go, Tom.
I was just going to say, when I was in high school, this book was kind of... was kind of shunned a little bit because it had kind of a evilish satanic feel to it, even though it was obviously fiction. But I remember several of my friends like, you shouldn't read that book.
Really?
Yep.
Well, can I interject in there, because that's a very, very Mormon thing, and it's addressed in the preface. And there's also there's a quote from Mere Christianity that goes along the same lines. C.S. Lewis says regarding falling prey to the devil, he says, one way is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them.
Yeah.
This is an utterly Mormon thing, because, first of all, in my family, we had two demon stories. My mom was attacked by a demon just before she got married to my dad, huge in our family folklore. And then, as you guys may know, I felt like I was attacked by a demon on my mission. And I remember many times, like, you would sit around with a bunch of other Mormons and you'd start talking about demon stories. And then, you know, you'd be warned, hey, you know, if you talk about this, you dwell on this too much, you're going to bring an evil spirit and you're going to give him power.
Right.
That's a very Mormon cultural thing.
Isn't it more than just Mormon, though? I mean, isn't there a lot of Christian faiths that feel the same way? Like, you must avoid all the very appearance of evil kind of thing?
Well, that's where that phrase, speak of the devil, comes from.
Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying it does apply to Mormons, too. I mean, really, in my experience, it does apply to Mormon culture.
But what was the second part that C.S. Lewis said that was unhealthy, to have an excessive fascination and interest on the devil?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, don't you see that? a lot in Mormon culture as well? I mean, like, we're always talking about, oh, don't do that because that'll make the devil happy. Or, I mean, you know, even like in the temple, who's the most interesting guy, the most colorful guy in that film?
Michael Ballum.
Michael Ballum. You know, I mean, the devil's he's the guy that, you know, keeps people in their seats.
Oh, one of my home teachers gave a whole lesson on the devil, and then the home teacher shared some demon stories from their mission, and then finished it up by bearing their testimony of Satan.
Right.
It was something else.
Yeah.
Well, I've got to say that when I was about halfway through the book, something that came to mind was Zilpha's interview, where she talked about her disaffection and how once she stopped believing in the devil, the world felt a whole lot safer to her than when she did believe in the devil. And as I was reading it, that's something I kept coming back to. Not so much safe, but how glad I am that this isn't really the case. Because the book kind of made it feel, kind of put across the story that humans aren't really in control of themselves. Yeah. The devil has a finger in their brain, and so does God, and it's this tug of war to try to make you behave this way or try to make you behave that way. And it's refreshing to not be bound by that belief, to understand that I am in full control of my thoughts and my actions, and that it's up to me rather than people pushing me this way or that.
Yeah, but it's
empowering.
But it's understandable, because a lot of times people experience chaos in their thoughts, and they can understand that there's good angels fighting for the good out that are unseen, and then there's the demons out there that are unseen that are fighting for the bad, and all of humanity's in this constant war, this constant struggle that we just can't see or feel or experience, but we're all just caught in the middle of it.
So you think people find that more comforting than the idea that it's just up to them and any chaos they might be experiencing, or any, I hate this term, but cognitive dissonance that they're experiencing is just something they need to work out themselves?
I don't know about
the reason.
I don't know about comforting, but I can see people being able to put one and two together to make it fit a little bit better in their mentalities.
I'd have to say that one of the best benefits of becoming an atheist is that I no longer think that something that went bump in the night could be a demon. I mean, growing up Mormon, I was completely and utterly credulous to the idea that demons could attack me. And I was attacked on my mission. So I had this fear all the time. Like, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I'd hear something, and I'd be afraid of the unseen world. Now the only thing I'm afraid of is a psycho breaking into the house. But that's one thing that Mormonism does, is it makes you really credulous to this unseen, dark, sinister world of these. And there's a quote. If somebody could please, if somebody else has heard this, tell me, because I used to teach, pretty much all I did in my adult time in the church was teach the young men. And there's this quote that says, if the veil could be lifted, it's either Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, you would see that there is three of the people who are cast out of heaven at each ear of every Latter-day Saint.
Yeah.
Has anyone heard that quote?
Yes, I've heard that. I can't attribute it, but I have heard that.
Right. And so I used to like to try to make the kids think to keep their attention. I looked up online once, and there's been 100 billion people that have ever lived. And I said, one third of the host of heaven was cast out. That means one half of 100 billion at least are out there tempting us. And they're going to focus especially on you, Latter-day Saint teenagers, because you're so special. And, the culture kind of creates this really – it did for me, this fear of this sinister, magical, unseen, evil world.
And that's something I thought was interesting about Screwtape Letters, that in contrast to the Mormon belief in a devil, where in Screwtape you've got one devil for this one patient, right? But as you said, you know, in Mormonism we think that there's like Legion. there's many that are after us. It's not just one. And in Screwtape, when at the end, when the patient dies and he sees for the first time who's been tempting him, that there's this reference that he also sees on the other side. He sees them. That almost as if there have been many angels that are on his side. It's almost like the opposite of what we think in LDS. That I guess in LDS view we do think that there are also like our ancestors and things like that are guarding us as well. But we've also got this team, don't we?
I never felt that way.
You don't think that there's people like your ancestors are guiding you and pushing you with invisible hands?
No,
they're busy doing missionary work.
Right. I always felt like they were watching me. You know what I mean? Not necessarily helping me, but like, oh, my dead grandma can see what I'm doing, so I better be good type of a thing.
Yeah.
So it was almost like we were left alone. At least that's the way I kind of, looking back on it now, I don't understand why I never felt like God was just leaving me alone. Maybe because we're supposed to use the Holy Ghost rather than guardian angels.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think I like this discussion about Mormonism and their obsession with demons and bad forces out there, because I think it does lend itself to Screwtape Letters, and perhaps that's why it's so beloved of the Mormon culture, because it fits in with their worldview.
And it seems safe. I mean, it seems like a safe way to engage in an interest in demonology, because Screwtape Letters defeats the demon. I mean, you know,
the bad guys lose.
The bad guys lose, and the good guys are validated. But at the same time, C.S. Lewis also, he kind of pokes fun at the arrogance and the foibles of even the good churchgoers. You know, like when Screwtape is telling Wormwood how to tempt the patient, and he's saying, "Oh, he's become a Christian." Oh, I see. Okay, well, make sure that when he's sitting in church, he's thinking about the people that are sitting around them and their singing voices.
How dorky they are.
How dorky they are.
And how hypocritical they are.
How hypocritical they are. You know, and all those things that we would go, oh, yeah, we do that. And it kind of validates that we do that. We kind of laugh at ourselves with it. I mean, that was the appeal to me when I first read it. I really liked that.
Right. Well, it's kind of also the alternate view of what C.S. Lewis says about intellectuals. But one of the themes in the book to me seemed that the devil thinks that church-going good people are dorky and hypocritical, and the devil understands that people who aren't good church-going Christians, the reason they're not dorky is they're only obsessed with appearances. They're only obsessed with what is fashionable. And the only thing that people who claim to be intellectuals care about is whether or not they're dissing what the masses believe. They don't actually believe in, they don't actually have a value system.
Yeah, I mean, he here's a quote. He says, "Don't waste time trying to make him think that materialism is true. Make him think it is strong or stark or courageous. That is the philosophy of the future." So it's not about the arguments of the intellectual. It's about feeling strong and fashionable and courageous and the wave of the future. Because he implies over and over that if Wormwood tries to take his patient into the realm of thinking about the great questions and the mysteries, that God takes it from there and God wins. Whereas in my experience, it's the opposite that's true. And why the Mormon Church is so cautious and has so many ways to try to keep people from becoming too intellectually minded.
That's how I felt. So did you feel insulted by all of the slamming and insulting of intellectualism?
Yeah, I'd say the most common thing I said out loud was, "Oh, come on." So, I mean, this anti-intellectualism is pervasive. I have multiple letters with anti-intellectualism in it. Anti-historian. We talked about historical Jesus. We'll talk more about that later.
We can talk about it now.
Well, I don't want to mess with the flow.
We're creating our own flow.
We're creating our flow.
He probably was just frustrated because he probably had a lot of skeptical and atheist colleagues over there at Oxford, not to mention students, and maybe this comes out of that he takes that sort of attitude towards people who think that they're smart.
Well, and wasn't that his background as well, that he started off as a skeptical atheist, and then he had some kind of a conversion?
And he claims to be.
Yeah, and that became his mission then to, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
To save other atheists, perhaps?
It's kind of contentious.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Randy on this one. That makes me skeptical because my experience has been that people who understand logical thought, or who have at least been on that side of the spectrum as opposed to faith, they wouldn't paint such a ridiculous caricature of intellectualism.
I mean, listen to this quote. He says, "But the best of all," this is a Screwtape talking to Wormwood, "but the best of all is to let him read no science, but to give him a grand general idea that he knows it all." Are you kidding me? He's saying that the devil doesn't want us to read science because science will lead us to God?
Well, I listen to an awful lot of evangelical Christian radio. I don't know why, but I do.
That's weird.
And they truly believe that there is real science that proves – they believe that the Bible is historical fact and can be proven with archaeology. They believe that science does – I can't go into all the details about it, but it seems to me that Lewis believes that there is real science out there that can be trusted, but that the devil has used intellectuals and their fascination with appearances to corrupt science to win souls for the devil as opposed to for God.
Yeah, but that quote could be applied a lot more aptly to the audience you're talking about. Give them a grand general idea that they know it all, because they can't back anything up with any data, whereas scientists can back up evolution with just mounds and mounds and mounds of data.
Well, and it's also arming that audience with the false understanding that people who claim science don't really know science, that what they just think that they know science, what they really know is the general understanding of science.
Right, or that it's no more reliable than their faith.
Right.
It's just another form of faith. Right.
You know what was cool for me when I read that is I don't see myself as an intellectual, so I wasn't offended.
That is cool.
Good for you, Tom. Good for you.
Was there anything that did offend you, Tom?
No. Nope.
Did you think that he was spot on about some things?
Spot on.
Or had the right general idea about things?
No.
Any of them stick out in particular for you?
Sheesh, put me on the spot. All right, well, I kept thinking, I thought it was interesting that, there was an order in it. And I think that's kind of where we can draw parallels to Mormonism, where, there's like a leader and then their little henchmen that go out and do orders and stuff like that. I thought that was interesting. I don't know if Christianity as a whole buys into that sort of thing, because if you flip that on its head and you take God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost, they're all one for the most part. Most Christianity take Trinity, and not Trinity from the Matrix. Trinity is the three. because in Mormonism, it's they're three separate individuals, and there's each of them have their orders and their responsibilities, and that I probably thought was the most interesting, I guess, as of right now, I think.
How about anybody else? Did anybody else have letters that spoke to them or that they thought had useful, good information in them?
Yeah, I liked the one about false humility and low self-esteem. He talks about tempting the patient to have a low opinion of himself.
And to believe that that's humility.
and to believe that that's humility. Yeah. And so, like, if he's a good singer, he would try to convince himself that he's not a good singer, which is a form of self-deception and not humility, not good in the long run. I really liked that. I liked this quote, when they have really learned to love their neighbors as themselves, they will be allowed to love themselves as their neighbors. I think a lot of times in Mormonism, you're not supposed to really love or care about yourself. And
you're supposed to forget yourself.
That that's not necessarily what the enemy, as Screwtape calls God, would want.
How about you, Glenn? Did you have any favorites?
Yeah, I still have a lot of favorites in it. I really like when Screwtape is telling Wormwood how to get the patient to focus on his mother and her annoying habits. And the best way to get him to focus on it is to get him to pray about it. But to make sure that when he's praying about it, he's never really actually praying about it. He's just thinking that he's praying about it, you know. And so it's all the subtleties where they're playing on the person's pride, that he thinks he's actually doing something really good when he's actually not doing anything at all. And it's kind of playing on that hypocrisy
of humans.
Yeah. And I think he calls it spiritual pride at one point. Mm-hmm. When the patient falls in with, he gets a girlfriend that's a Christian girlfriend, and he starts hanging around with her crowd, the advice is, will make him think that this is his kind of people and that all other people are less than him, and, kind of use this to, it's all about building up pride, kind of the us versus them type thing. I think there's interesting comments on the human condition and foibles of humanity still throughout this that still make me pause and think that I still find value in Screwtape letters.
Go for it.
I was going to say, I totally agree with Glenn, because a lot of this book does have some insight into human nature.
Yeah.
You don't have to posit that there's a demon pulling the strings or there's a guardian angel pulling the strings. But, for instance, you were talking about his relationship with his mother. I didn't write any notes on this, but I vaguely remember him talking about the hypocrisy of her expressions in his mind, over-exaggerating what she meant, and then he would have the same expression to her, but he would have the purest perception of what he meant. And there's just a lot of human nature that he taps into.
Yeah.
That was worthy and insightful if you take out the demon part. The other thing I like was
it's a metaphor.
Letter 13 reveals that C.S. Lewis isn't a born again Christian like we know them today. Because he says, no amount of piety in his imagination and affections will harm us if we can keep it out of his will. In other words, faith without works is dead. So if actions count, and I do like that about Mormonism, actions count. I think they take it a little too far about saving yourself and getting a little nuts with that. But your actions do count, and all the flowery imagination and affections don't amount to anything if you don't actually act it out. So I like that.
Go ahead, Heather.
I
was just going to ask, do we know what C.S. Lewis was, his religion that he subscribed to?
He's an Anglican.
Anglican?
That's basically decaffeinated Catholicism. It's the Church of England.
All right.
They have a lot of the same beliefs. Like, you remember Limbo was mentioned in the book somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, it's basically Catholicism with an English flavor.
You're allowed to divorce Catherine of Aragon.
Right.
King Henry VIII.
Yeah, yes.
It would be Episcopalian here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's definitely not an evangelical, but I agree with Randy. I thought that there were, truisms throughout. There was... one of the letters that was about keeping the human. It was letter 6, actually, that was about it's okay for your patient to fantasize about his morality and becoming a better person as long as it never makes it into his will, as long as it's not something he's actually doing. And that's something that I think that at least rung true to me about, you know, those things that you think, I'm going to be better about doing this tomorrow. I'm going to start a diet on Monday. That's, I think, just part of the human condition. If all you ever do is think about it, if all you ever do is fantasize about starting it, it's never going to actually cause positive change in your life. And I thought it was interesting that C.S. Lewis picked up on that.
Related to really my favorite part, and the one that I found sort of like helpful and uplifting and instructive, was letter 15, which he talks about the future and, you know, where do we want humans to live? Do we want them to live oriented in the present or the past or the future or eternity? And he says, hence, nearly all vices are rooted in the future. And that was really interesting to me because I'm trying really hard to live in the present and not the future. He goes on to say, we want a whole race perpetually in pursuit of the rainbow's end, never honest nor kind nor happy now, but always using as mere fuel wherewith to heap the altar of the future every real gift which is offered them in the present. I thought that was really interesting. Not an attitude that I would, I guess, normally associate with Christianity.
Well, I think that it's not a Mormon idea. When I read that letter, I wrote down, isn't this the exact opposite of what we believe? We believe that the bad thing is to think about now. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. It's bad to be concerned with what's going on with yourself right now and to be hedonistic.
Yeah, you want to have that eternal perspective. It's right. Always the eternal perspective. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, before we get off that, I mean, that's kind of what C.S. Lewis was saying as well, is that he wanted them to have the eternal perspective. But to him, he thought that the past was the closest to eternity that a human's able to conceive of, because the past already has these determined points in it that, you know, for God, God's able to see the future and the eternities with all these determined things that have already happened, but humans can't. You know, when we look forward, we can't see that. So when we look at the future, it's just all crazy, and that's where the devils have power over us. That's why they want us looking into the future. But so what you're saying, Heather, is that you saw that was kind of against what the Mormon view is?
Right. I've always thought that thinking about just today was bad. It's hedonistic. It's not caring for the consequences of tomorrow, where C.S. Lewis is saying that we should keep that the bad thing is to focus on the future. What God wants them is to focus on today.
That's why the importance of being sealed in the temple, Glenn. You don't just get married civilly, dude, because that's like getting married for today. You get married in the temple, bam, got your future intact.
Yeah. So
the hymn, put your shoulder to the wheel, push along, is kind of a, you know, let's get to work today kind of attitude, to be fair to Mormonism.
Do
your home teaching this month. I mean, there's so much stuff you got to be doing right now.
Yeah, you're taking care of today and tomorrow and eternity all in the same.
And what about all your ancestors in the past?
What about them?
Oh, you got to do genealogy. You're getting sealed. You got to do genealogy. Yeah.
You got to do your genealogy.
So, but
we all want to turn around.
So, put both shoulders to the wheel, then.
So, do you think C.S. Lewis would see that as us falling prey to Satan's tempting, then? Because we're thinking of both the past and the future rather than right now.
I think he would. I think that he would look at all of these things that don't necessarily make you a good person and don't necessarily help other people. All of these things that tasks that we set up for ourselves and distract ourselves with. And we're so busy with that sort of thing that we don't really have time to consider what really matters. Yeah. I don't think C.S. Lewis would have been a fan.
Yeah. Screw tape would say to Wormwood, make them feel like they are saviors upon Mount Zion. Make them feel like going to their ceremonies and doing their rituals is actually doing good in the world, while other people sit by hungry and, you know, make them feel like what they're doing is making a difference. I think that's the way that C.S. Lewis would approach it in writing a Screwtape Letters directed towards Mormons.
Towards Mormons.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting book.
Yeah. I don't think Neil A. Maxwell's going to write that one.
So were there any letters that made any of you cringe about your own behavior?
About our own behavior now?
Well, yeah. Time. Did you see yourself in any of the criticism?
Here's I'll be a little vulnerable. I remember thinking, maybe there's something to all this Satanism and devil stuff. Maybe it's not so bad.
What?
Yeah. What?
I want to hear more about that, Tom.
I mean,
I'll back you up on this one if you need, Tom.
Not so bad or not so crazy sounding?
Yeah, maybe not so crazy sounding. It sounds, I mean, yeah. I mean,
not so crazy that Satan's tempting us?
Well, and the way things work, and they sounded a lot more intellectual, and they sounded like they knew what they were doing. And I mean, Screwtape sounded like he had his head on straight. I wanted to hear more from Wormwood, because I think that he could probably have a lot to offer.
Wormwood is no longer with us.
He's not?
He got consumed.
No, he got eaten.
Got eaten by Screwtape.
Yeah,
that's right.
But we also never got Wormwood's letters to Screwtape. We only got the one-way conversation.
Well, we got implications of what he said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we only ever got the response from Screwtape to Wormwood, so we never heard Wormwood's reports. Yeah. But I think you raised an interesting point though, Tom, because I mean, and I see this as a difference between the Christian view of devils and the Mormon view of devils, where, you know, in Christianity, devils are a completely different creation than humans, and this is touched on a little bit in Screwtape, where, you know, God creates a new order of beings, which are humans, and that's kind of what insults Lucifer in the first place and incites a war in heaven. But in the Mormon version of the story, there's, you know, we're all brothers and sisters, and it's the plan of salvation that creates the conflict. And these spirits are just one third of our family that chose not to keep the first estate. And supposedly they didn't go through this veil of forgetfulness that we've gone through, so they remember who we are. And you hear this in Mormon folklore that they'll remember. I mean, they'll look and they'll go, oh yeah, that's Tom Perry. I remember him from the pre-existence. I know what his strengths and weaknesses are.
Well, he was valiant fighting, yeah, against Satan.
And you don't have any of that in Screwtape at all.
Actually, in letter 19, there's kind of like a little implication of what C.S. Lewis sees. With, you know, because you can't deny that in Revelations, I think it's chapter 12, verse 9. It says that Satan was cast out of heaven.
Right.
So he says Satan, he implies that Satan chose to leave because he was offended at God's lack of confidence in him.
Yeah.
And then he leaves, and there's really no, I couldn't find any indication of, well, who are all these demons under Satan?
Right.
Whereas the LDS theology has a description that they are the intelligence, one third of the intelligence is at the beginning, that we're our brothers and sisters that do have a total understanding. And there's a line from Screwtape, it's in letter 30 or 31, where he says, if only I could know what God was up to.
Right.
It basically revealed that C.S. Lewis doesn't think that Satan knows the plan of salvation, whereas in Mormon theology, Satan has a perfect understanding of the plan of salvation. Therefore, he makes him very effective to thwart it.
Yep, exactly.
Well, I mean, I went into this too with the Mormon mentality, like, okay, you remember Satan's plan? He was his plan was to save all the souls, you know, to eliminate free agency, as it were. And then actually, that's a pretty good idea. He doesn't lose any souls, You know, that way Heavenly Father's pleased, like, hey, look, I brought them all back. Except for Jesus said, well, I think free agency thing's a good idea. But in my mind, I'm like, you know, Satan or Beelzebub had a good idea. He wanted to save everybody.
My understanding is that Beelzebub or Satan or Lucifer, whoever you want to call him, he didn't understand how things worked. When he proposed a plan that we would all be saved, according to Mormon theology, we would not truly become like God because we wouldn't have gone through the trial and exercise our agency, then become like God. We would all have been slaves to Satan for eternity.
Yeah, but
that's
but,
my understanding of the Mormon theology.
But Satan's heart was in the right place. I mean, but while he had a heart, you know.
I don't think that his heart was in the right place, according to Mormon theology. I think that he wanted all the glory, according to Mormon theology. And he disguised it as – he disguised his plan as a way to save everybody when really his heart was to give all the glory to himself. That's
true,
my understanding.
True, but his plan – had a lot of logic and reason behind it because it did sway a third of the host to heaven. I mean, I'm sure they didn't say, ah, oh, he's so selfish. He just wants all the power to himself. They probably said, yeah, I'm on board. I mean, that's why they went
with
him, right?
I feel like I'm arguing about why the orcs were.
And then Gandalf comes down and.
Yeah.
Right. That's how I feel about this argument, but you win, Tom. That, I mean, I expressed what I thought about the way I perceive Mormon theology as a believer is basically what I've expressed.
Well, I went into this book though because I, you know, with the idea that this was a shunned book and it's not a good idea to try to get in the mindset or try to be sympathetic to Satan or how demons work and stuff like that. And so I kind of felt a little dirty trying to listen to this, and I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I can understand why this is. Probably a lot of people don't think this is a good read. This is a good idea. You don't want to get in the mindset of anybody that's evil. I mean, it kind of goes reflective of in the 80s when the church got so upset about that movie, The Exorcist. Remember that?
That movie is such awful fiction, by the way.
And they said, don't watch that. Don't watch that. And, you know. They avoid the very appearance of evil. That's the whole deal.
So, Tom, did you feel a dark spirit come over you when you read this book?
Probably not like what you experienced on your mission, but I felt a little heebie-jeebies. Yeah.
Did you? Yeah. You know, since we're talking about, you know, the LDS idea of devils, this has always been something that's interested me. Is what really motivates the devils to tempt anyway? I mean, if Lucifer's been cast out, fine, be cast out. And what is it, the saying about the apostates? You leave the church, you can't leave it alone. Well, I mean, he's left the host of heaven. Why can't he leave it alone? Why is Lucifer so intent on tempting us? What does he get out of it?
He gets more. He gets to recruit. You know, it's like a college football coach. He's trying to get more on his team.
But
that works in Christianity, but it doesn't work in Mormonism.
In Mormonism, there's not
he
really an answer
to it. He wants us to be miserable.
Yeah,
I've always considered it as misery enjoys company, and that instinct is what drives Lucifer. Is that he's miserable, so he wants to drag everyone down to him.
Yeah, I think that's kind of clear in letter 11. That was about humor and flippancy. Yeah. That letter actually made me feel kind of bad for the Mormon devil, not necessarily for this
Mormon
incarnation, but the way Mormons believe in the devil. Because if we believe in letter 14, there was a line that said that self-loathing is the root of mistreating others. It's the root of being awful to other people. I wish I could pull it up at the moment. But anyway, that made me go back to when I was reading letter 11. It made me think about the Mormon incarnation of the devil. He probably, where Lewis says that the devil doesn't understand humor, the Mormon devil would understand humor and music and light and happiness and human connection. And he would probably be pained to have had that removed from him. And so the source of his behavior and the source of his constant obsession with bringing humans to hell is out of that pain. That pain causes him to mistreat others and lash out, basically. It kind of made me feel bad for the Mormon devil.
You mentioned music. That made me laugh because I didn't have this in my notes, but he was talking about how music can't be used as a tool, and I'm like, this was written in 1941 before rock and roll was invented. True. Before Nine Inch Nails and Black Sabbath.
Yeah. Buddy Holly was the first satanic music.
Right. That's rock and roll. Rock and roll was invented in 55. This was written in 41. America hadn't even entered World War II. He keeps calling it the European War.
Right.
So I thought that kind of dated this book. It was the fact that he felt like he couldn't use music as a weapon.
Yeah. So you know, I think what C.S. Lewis would say about the motivation of the devils we touched on earlier, it's food
and fear. The reason they are so desperate to tempt you to hell is because if you don't, they do.
But they feed off of us, right? I mean, that's their sustenance. And they eat the souls of humans. They eat each other. That's how they're fueled.
Mm-hmm. Kind of creepy.
Yeah, but it's not Mormon, because Mormon is eternal matter. It's intelligences that can neither be created nor destroyed. So you wouldn't have new devils going through training and graduating an MTC type thing.
There's
coming into the field. Yeah, there's a finite number. They wouldn't be destroyed or eaten like Wormwood is at the end.
You end up in the Telestial Kingdom, which, from what I hear, that's where I'm going. But from what I hear, that's
kill
nicer.
Yourself to get there.
You'd kill yourself to get there. It's nicer than this world now. Yeah. You know, living in America is a pretty good life.
Right.
And so it's nicer than this world now. It's totally different. And that's one of the best things about Mormonism is they shunned the traditional notion of hell, which is, to me, is completely insidious doctrine of traditional fundamentalist Christianity.
So the devil doesn't even get you, right?
No.
I mean, so
for a season,
even with this pain and misery that he wants, you've got to go to outer darkness for him to get that, right?
Yeah, in Mormon theology. Yeah.
Where's Andrea?
Screwtape mentions outer darkness. Kind of. He says something about utter cold and utter space or something.
Yeah.
I underlined it. Anyway. He does mention that. I thought that was interesting. I was really confused, though, because I don't understand how you can be tortured in hell for eternity if you get eaten. I mean, what happens after you're eaten? You don't exist anymore?
Yeah.
Good question.
In the toast.
Maybe you have to work. Maybe you have to experience going through the colon and all that stuff. I don't know.
Nice thought, Tom.
That would suck.
In Screwtape proposes a toast, he laments the shortage of really wicked souls, because apparently the more wicked they are, the better they taste. And, you know, how are you tortured for all of eternity if you just get eaten and then it's over? I don't understand.
Maybe their digestive system is very, very slow.
Might work.
Glenn, I thought that you would be the best person to comment on letter 11. I even wrote at the top of the chapter, Glenn's chapter.
Why was there a lot of bad jokes in it?
Yeah, the chapter is on humor and how the devil uses it. And guess what the devil's number one weapon is?
Incongruity?
Flippancy.
Flippancy.
And you're the most flippant person I know.
Yeah, I skipped over that one.
Yeah.
He's like, I've got that memorized.
Next.
Tom sigh.
Yeah, that was a Tom sigh.
Thanks.
Yeah, I actually don't have anything on that.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I could go on and on about all the Mormonisms in here.
The Mormonisms in there? Like Mormonisms?
Yeah. What about the spirit upon his reconversion? He has the spirit with him. I mean, that's what I thought when I was a kid.
Well, and not only that, there's
the old mill, and there's like an impenetrable force around him, so Wormwood can't get to him.
Right. The house of his fiance is completely protected. by this this magical spiritual mist. That's you know, putting the whole armor of God in around your house. You know, building the, you know, as a priesthood holder, you know, you protect your house from the influence of Satan. How many times did I pray that our house would be protected from the influence of the adversary? And according to C.S. Lewis, there are houses that are completely protected, like Andrea said, by this mist. And there's certain people that they can't touch.
Isn't that what happens when you when each temple is dedicated? There's like a mist that's put around there.
Yes.
No one can see.
I used to believe that when I'd be in the temple, that I could not, any thoughts that were evil that I'd have in the temple were my own, because yeah. Satan couldn't get in.
Right. Well, I believe that with garments.
But right? Bad thoughts could come in if you're wearing garments?
No, but that you've got this protection.
Yeah, that's a common.
Like from bullets, right? And stuff?
From devils. That it gives you extra protection against, because you're covering.
Demon possession?
You're covering your special parts. So the devils can't, like.
I was surprised by how many letters were devoted to, like, chastity and that kind of thing. Because in Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis says that chastity is not a big deal. I mean, he says it's one of the less serious sins, that spiritual sins like pride are much more serious than sexual sin. So I was surprised how many of these letters were devoted to it.
I was curious, Randy, when you were talking about that C.S. Lewis was mentioned more times than Christ in conference. How many times has the Screwtape Letters ever been mentioned in conference, ever? Or by any general authority?
Did I say that it was a joke?
Now I've got my tongue in cheek. Relax, man.
Screwtape Letters? That's a really good question.
Does anybody know of a general authority quoting the Screwtape Letters at all?
Why would they not? Because they want to warn people of the adversary and his methods. I mean, 2 Nephi 28 and 2 Nephi 9 talk about his, his methods and his techniques. Why would they not tap into Screwtape Letters in conference? That's actually a really good question, but I don't have an answer for you, Tom.
Hmm. How about you, Glenn? How about a fake answer?
42.
Well, I just got onto LDS.org and searched Screwtape Letters, and I see in 2001 April conference, Marlon K. Jensen referenced them.
No kidding.
Wow. Awesome.
You are awesome. And that probably took less than 15 seconds.
Less. I want to ask the women, did you pick up on the sexist parts of the book?
Yeah, I was really glad that...
Why are you just asking the women, Randy?
Because they would be... Yeah, because I'm a misogynist, so I just wanted to... Did you guys highlight letter 24?
Yes, there were, but not so much as the other places, not so much as in other places I didn't, but I did pick up on the fact that she's not even capable of real vanity.
Can I read a quote from letter 24?
Go for it.
It is an unobtrusive little vice, which she, the fiance, shares with nearly all women who have grown up in an intelligent circle united by a clearly defined belief. And it consists in a quite untroubled assumption that the outsiders who do not share this belief are really too stupid and ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So women naturally have this predisposition when they are brought up in a righteous and intelligent household to think that other people that aren't like them are that way because they're stupid and ridiculous. They don't have the intellectual capacity to parse that out, the nuance of that. So,
yeah, I didn't catch that
bothered
it that way,
me, but I mean, that's how I felt. I don't know, like junior high and high school. That's how I felt about people who weren't like me.
Come on!
I can't believe they believe that. That's ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, but guys think that too. To single out women as if they are the only ones that have that, that fall into that trap. Come on.
Oh, I know. I mean, the anytime women are mentioned in this whole thing, it's, you know, he was a bit of a misogynist, and that's pretty obvious.
The other thing, though, is that he says, C.S. Lewis says at the beginning, in the preface, that Screwtape is a liar. And so you got to wonder sometimes, and maybe I'm giving him a little bit too much credit here, but you got to wonder sometimes if Screwtape, because he's got ulterior motives, he wants to devour Wormwood. So there might be times where he's giving Wormwood advice that may not be in Wormwood's best interest to win the patient over to hell.
I don't think so, because then what is the point of this book? The point of this book is to show that the all the different ways, the traps that the devil can ensnare people.
But it's also
if you can't take anything at face value for what Wormwood's saying or Screwtape is saying, then nothing means anything.
Yeah. It's also to show that hell is doomed. That the powers that be of hell will ultimately consume themselves.
Really?
It's a faulty model. Because it's not built on love and charity, which is what God's kingdom is really built on. They're all out to consume each other.
So then is he lying in the toast when he says that the quality of the spirits are not as tasty as, say, Caligula, that there's still quite an abundance of them, that more and more and more are available, that there's no famine?
I don't know.
Can't get into the mind of Screwtape?
I don't know. I don't know if he's lying about this one, about the women. He might not be.
There were other things in there that made me think that's a thing, that he was probably being honest there.
Yeah.
I guess.
There was the time he was talking, Screwtape was talking about the way that men and women approach selfishness differently.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was interesting. I mean, there was a lot of the, you know, men do things this way, women do things this way that was in the book. You know, how much of that's C.S. Lewis, how much of that is Screwtape, how much of that's part of the game? I don't know. But I think there was a lot of playfulness that was going on. There were parts that were more obvious where Screwtape is obviously giving Wormwood misinformation. This may not be one of those times, but I just wanted to argue with you, Randy.
You're making me completely reconsider the whole book.
Good.
Okay, he's making me officially confused. I don't know what he's talking
about. Can I change gears a little bit?
Yes.
Okay. Glenn and I saw we held hands while we watched the Book of Mormon musical.
No.
Okay, he sat behind me when we watched the Book of Mormon musical, but he did massage my shoulders. Okay, you can edit that out. Remember when we talked about the Mormon kind of view of because Elder Price was talking about how – or basically was like having a faith crisis because none of his prayers were being answered.
Yeah.
Okay. So in letter 27 – Screwtape says, don't forget to use the heads I win tells you lose argument, which basically says if the prayer doesn't happen, then it's proof that prayers don't work. If it does happen, he will, of course, be able to see some of the physical causes which led up to it, and therefore it would have happened anyway. To me, this is the opposite of what Mormons think. The heads I win tells you lose is the opposite. God can't lose in the Mormon heads I win tells you lose. If your prayer is answered, God answered it. If it's not answered, well, then you needed to learn a lesson or the answer was no. So either way, God wins in the Mormon way of looking at this.
Yeah, I agree with that, Randy. I think this is another example of C.S. Lewis demonstrating the ultimate failing of Screwtape's overconfidence, that he's so supremely confident in his own demonic superiority that it's ultimately going to fail because he's wrong. All of the advice that he gives to Wormwood fails in the end. Everything that he tells him to do, it backfires.
Now you're making me rethink the book.
But I don't think that's the case, though, because he was constantly chastising Wormwood for the things he didn't do.
Yeah.
And saying how...
That's all up front.
Oh, goodness. I think it's a bad idea to argue literature with somebody who has a PhD in mythology. Or what is your PhD in, Glenn?
It's not. I didn't.
You can argue with Glenn about anything. Believe.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
He's a PhD, he has more.
I don't ABD. Have a PhD. Yeah.
ABD, all but dissertation in folklore.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, you're far more experienced at analyzing these things than I am. Not that that means I think I should just accept what you say, but you say things and I'm like, oh, why didn't I consider that point of view?
Because it's ridiculous. Don't worry about it, Heather. I think you're great.
Yeah. I do too. I think you're great too.
Tom is very concerned with the size of your ego, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm concerned.
No, actually,
about it
too. Everybody is.
Yeah.
So, at what point do we get to review the book, like on a scale of 1 to 10? Because I didn't really care for it on the whole.
Wait a minute! You were like totally. You made it sound like it totally converted your worldview that demons exist. Maybe this is Satan's.
No, hang on, Heather.
He said he wanted to become a Satanist.
Yeah. I started wearing red and
looking for a coven.
No, Heather asked me what my favorite part was, Randy, and that's all I said. I was like, well, I guess it was
this. I don't like the way you said my name. Randy. You said it like you had a piece of shit in your mouth.
Whoa. I'm sorry, Randy.
Okay, so let's do it right now. Starting with Tom. Review the book. Rate it.
I didn't think it was very good. I mean, but I come at this with not a very big appreciation for C.S. Lewis. I didn't care for his Narnia stuff either. So I give it like a 4 out of 10.
Andrea?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the parts that I liked, I really liked. And the parts that I didn't like, I really didn't dislike. I really disliked. So... I don't know. I think it's worth reading, but you'll probably like it more if you're religious. Put it that way.
Glenn?
Well, wait. There was no number there.
Oh.
Do I really have to give it a number?
Tom gave it a 4.
Yeah.
Well, then I will give it a 5. I will give it a 5.5. I'll give it a 5.5. But the parts that I liked, like I liked letter 11 and I liked whatever the one was on the future.
You like the assault on humor?
It wasn't an assault. It was an assault on flippancy.
Yeah.
But which I can go along with because I'm not a big fan of flippancy. The parts that I like, I would give maybe an 8.5.
And the parts that you don't like are 5.5.
Yeah.
Okay. So it averages out to about a 7.
Don't average it. That doesn't work.
All right. I was just being flippant.
Oh, boy.
I know.
Yeah. All right. So, Heather, you were asking me. I really like it. I like satire. I think that C.S. Lewis does a masterful job with it. Obviously, I don't see things the way that he does, but this isn't about me agreeing with him. I think that his execution of this, the idea behind it, is fantastic. So I'm going to give it high marks. I'll give it a 9.
A 9?
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Is that a joke? That's you being funny.
No, I'll read it again. This is one of those things that I'll go back to and read and keep reading. It's one of my favorites. I love Screwtape Letters.
So every time you read it, are you going to learn something new or find something that you didn't find in there the time you read it before?
Yeah, because I've never completely read it. I always read it in pieces. I read through it. I read different pieces of it. And
the Screwtape Letters is the foundation to Glenn's belief system, right? the cornerstone, I should say.
It is. Yeah. There's never a more pure book. What's the quote?
It's the most correct book.
It's the most correct book of any. Randy knew where I was going with that.
Yeah.
Okay, Randy, give us your take.
I'll be honest. It was tedious. It was a lot of work. the chapter in which he pontificated on how this stuffy old woman would fuss about her tea. Gosh, you know what I'm talking about? You know what chapter I'm talking about?
Gluttony.
Like she's going to hell.
No, I skim past the tedious parts. That's how I can give it a 9.
Her gluttony was not in eating too much. Her gluttony was in being what's the word?
Her delicacy. She's being delicate.
Yeah. Anyways, it was tedious. It was difficult to read. His anti-intellectualism was insulting. But I give him a 3. Instead of a 0.
Instead of a 0.
Because he did have some insights into human nature. And adding the demon is superfluous. So unnecessary. Just write a story that gives insight into human nature like Shakespeare did. And
because Shakespeare didn't use fictional characters. Come on.
No. But he didn't pretend they were real, Glenn.
Oh, he's not pretending that Screwtape is real.
No, but he believes that demons are real, does he not?
Sure, but not Screwtape. Yeah. This is all fictional.
Glenn.
Yeah, intentionally fictional. He still
fictional.
Thinks the devil's real.
Not intentionally
this is not fictional. The same way that Shakespeare is fictional.
Randy's going off. There's a premise in science, and I can't remember the name of – is it Occam who proposed it? That you don't add superfluous pieces to your theory to make them work. So Randy thinks that adding the devil mate was a superfluous move in describing human behavior.
Oh, yeah. It creates so many more problems than it than answers to any questions.
And that's going to make it less tedious.
Yeah. You got to remember, I'm an atheist, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't think we've forgotten.
Oh, I forgot.
Yeah. So, no. I'm sorry.
All right.
Sorry, it's like 11 o'clock here, so.
Okay.
Glenn, let him get through his review, would you?
Yes. I do think that he had some interesting insights in human nature, and I give him that. But I really – his anti-intellectualism and his narcissism just – it was a difficult read. It was the hardest 200 pages I've read in a long time.
And you recently read Pure Mormonism blog, didn't you? I will stop.
That doesn't have page numbers.
Okay. Love your rock.
That's a whole nother topic.
Yeah. We're getting ready to do something with rock, so we'll love it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, should I give it my rating now then?
Of course. I want to hear you from
I agree with Randy. I think it has some very good insights into human behavior. One of the letters talks about he gets new intellectual friends and he becomes uncomfortable. At some point, he's going to realize that the things that his intellectual friends are talking about actually run contrary to everything he believes. But he's going to be so uncomfortable with contradicting them that he won't say anything. And so he'll laugh when he should be silent and he'll be silent when he should say something. And that actually kind of spoke to me. I'm typically an outspoken person, and there have been times where I've kept my mouth shut with both people who are, you know, on the non-religious side of things, but also on the religious side of things. And so that kind of made me cringe about my own behavior a little bit that, oh, there's times when I should actually say, actually, I don't agree with you, than letting people have the false perception that I believe with them. Now that I'm not really a believer anymore, I kind of look at religious dogma is kind of more in the vein of philosophy, good, you know, good advice, talking about the foibles of human nature. And, you know, you should try to become a master of yourself. I think it's Plato, Aristotle, who talks about that, like the biggest war you'll ever win is with control over yourself. And so those parts of the book actually spoke to me. But as for it didn't do anything to help my faith. I didn't look at any of this and think, wow, that's really insightful. The devil really is trying to tempt me in that way.
So it didn't even help your faith in Satan at all either?
Nope, it really didn't. I don't know. I find his writing style a little tedious, which is weird because one of my all-time favorite books is Till We Have Faces, which was written by C.S. Lewis. But this particular book, I found myself I don't know if anybody else has experienced this, but when you're reading the scriptures and you realize you're not actually paying attention to the words that are on the page, it's thought. I found myself doing that with this book several times, and I had to like back up and reread letters. So I think I'll give it a 5 overall.
So the tally, we got 3, a 5, a 9. Tom, would you give
5.5
Well, I gave it a, but I gave it a 4, but I thought I was going to be the lowest, but you hit a 3, so I'll choose 2. Who's got the lowest score now, Randy?
Give it a 0.
Yeah, that's true. He did say I would have given it a 0, but
no, I mean, honestly, he did have some interesting insights in human nature. I got to give him that. I mean, he's not an idiot. C.S. Lewis is not an idiot. I'm not trying to convey that message, but I think that he believed in. I'll just leave it at that. He's not an idiot.
I guess I like it the most.
Well, congratulations, Glenn.
Win.
You win.
All right. Hey, thanks everybody for coming on. It was a good discussion, right? Even if you guys didn't really like it very much.
It was a decent discussion about a bad book. Yep.
Not a bad book. It's one I...
All right. No, not a bad book. An awful book.
Oh, for heaven's sake. All right.
Well, nobody can accuse Mormon Expression of only having one opinion, right?
Yeah, there you go.
From 9 to 3.
Yeah.
Or no, 2. 2. Tom changes it to 2.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't you close it up for us, Heather?
All right. The discussion will continue at MormonExpression.com.
All right. I'm going to see if I can go schedule a root canal now.
You got to go to church, Tom?
Yeah. Are you going to rub it in my face, atheist? Come on, rub it in my face. If that makes you feel better up on your little perch there.